Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, October 5th, 2023. In the news tonight, Idaho Supreme Court grants $80,000 in attorney's fees to Idahoans for open primaries. In ballot title dust-up with Attorney General Raul Labrador, Idaho Department of Agriculture says invasive mussels in Snake River near Twin Falls are serious challenges to ecosystems and infrastructure. And Moscow City Council candidates discuss low-income and so-called affordable housing at League of Women Voters Forum last night. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho Supreme Court has ordered the State Attorney General's Office and Secretary of State's Office to pay Idahoans for open primaries and their supporters $80,000 in attorney's fees this week. The court entered the order Monday, saying in an opinion, Attorney General Raul Labrador acted without a reasonable basis in law when he wrote the ballot title for the measure. According to the Idaho Press, the High Court's opinion says the Attorney General's short and general ballot titles contained a blatant misstatement concerning what the initiative would require. The general title failed to fully and accurately explain how the ranked choice voting method would work. Finally, both ballot titles instead contained the never-before-used term non-party blanket primary. Although the state Supreme Court ruled in favor of Idahoans for Open Primaries motions to prevent the state from using Labrador's initial ballot titles and awarded attorney's fees, they ruled against requests to prohibit Labrador from writing new ballot titles and to extend the April 30th, 2024 deadline for gathering enough signatures to get the initiative on the November 2024 ballot. Idahoans for Open Primaries says it had to delay starting their signature drive during the active summer months until the ballot title issue was resolved. The majority of the court ruled Labrador's new ballot titles comply with state law and comply with an earlier state Supreme Court order issued on August 10th. The initiative would replace the current closed primary election system that Republicans are using with open primaries that any voter could participate in regardless of party affiliation. All candidates for a position would run against each other in the primary, no matter the party, and the top four vote-getters would advance to the general election, where there would be an instant runoff or ranked choice system in which voters would place a vote for their first choice and then rank the remaining three candidates. If no candidate wins 50% of the vote, then candidates would be eliminated based on the ranked choices from voters. The last place candidate would be eliminated, and their votes would be transferred to the second choice candidate on each of those ballots until one candidate emerges as the winner by claiming a majority of the original and transferred votes. In early July, Idahoans for Open Primaries and Reclaim Idaho sued Labrador over the long and short ballot titles that he submitted June 30th, saying the 20-word and 200-word maximum ballot titles the Attorney General's office wrote misrepresented the initiative and showed Labrador's bias against the initiative. The short ballot title Labrador submitted by the June 30th deadline as required by law said, quote, measure to 1. Replace voter selection of party nominees with non-party blanket primary, 2. Require ranked choice voting for general voting for general election. Labrador's new 20-word maximum ballot title says, measure to 1. Replace voter selection of party nominees with a top four primary, 2. Require a ranked choice voting system for general elections. After the state Supreme Court ruled in early August that Labrador must rewrite the ballot titles, Labrador submitted the new ballot title that eliminated the use of the term non-party blanket primary. The court had agreed with Idahoans for Open Primaries that the use of the term non-party blanket primary is obscure and does not abide by state law, which requires the short title to use, quote, words which the measure is commonly referred to or spoken of. The new short ballot title also responded to the Supreme Court's view, agreeing with Idahoans for Open Primaries, that it would be misleading to say the initiative requires ranked choice voting because voters in the general election would have the option of only marking their ballots for their one preferred candidate and not participating in ranking the remaining three candidates in the race. Labrador changed that by saying in the ballot title the initiative would require the system rather than require a certain type of voting at the voting booth. However, Justice John Stegner dissented with the court's opinion that the new ballot title complies with state law regarding initiative ballot titles. Judge Stegner said the new short ballot title, which says, quote, measure to one, replace voter selection of party nominees with a top four primary, two, require a ranked choice voting system for general elections, unquote, is not accurate either because it would replace voter selection of party nominees only for the Republican Party but not the Democratic Party because Democrats already have open primaries in which any qualified voter can participate as long as they don't vote in any other primary on primary election day. Former Republican Idaho Attorney General and former State Supreme Court Justice Jim Jones, who is now a spokesperson for Idahoans for Open Primaries, said the people of Idaho will now have to pay $80,000 to the Open Primaries Coalition's attorneys because Attorney General Labrador's ballot titles were unlawful. That is not a surprise because he vowed to run a political office and he was strongly opposed to the initiative. We expected he would try to undermine the initiative with biased ballot titles, but the court refused to put up with his misconduct. Unfortunately, the taxpayers will have to pay the price. The Idaho Press reports Attorney General's Office spokesperson Beth Cahill wrote in an email this week, Reclaim Idaho asked for an excessive fee award from the state. The Supreme Court rejected their full request and ordered a more reasonable amount. Raul Labrador has previously said he will sue if the Open Primaries Initiative gets enough signatures to get on the ballot, claiming the initiative addresses two separate issues, the new primary system, and the top four runoff during the general election. Supporters of the initiative say it only addresses one issue, and that is elections. If the initiative passes, it will likely end the far-right stranglehold on the state Republican Party and the far-right's significant influence on Idaho politics in general. As such, the initiative has received support from a number of prominent Republicans in the state. In mid-September, former Idaho Governor Butch Otter joined with 115 other Republicans in announcing their support for the Idaho Open Primaries Initiative. Otter said during a press conference at the state capitol at the time, "What I see today is a lot of people running for office. Unfortunately, most of them on our side, on the Republican side, that haven't got the skill to convince people to be on their side. So the only thing they can do is tear them down personally." You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP Community Radio is proudly supported by Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006.
The six candidates for Moscow City Council took on the topics of affordable housing, the city's future water supply, growth of the city, and the city's climate resilience at a League of Women Voters Candidates Forum at the 1912 Center last night. The candidates are incumbent City Council member Sandra Kelly, Recent University of Idaho political science graduate Nathan Tupper, retired WSU philosophy professor Joe Campbell, former city council candidate and former Board of Adjustment member Evan Holmes, current city council member Drew Davis, and University of Idaho philosophy instructor Bryce Blankenship. On the issue of dealing with the city's housing shortage, the candidates seem to agree the state limits how much local governments can control development, but there may be ways around that, such as incentives. Candidate Evan Holmes spoke about the various ways the city can encourage affordable housing. Here's Holmes, followed by incumbent Sandra Kelly and candidate Nathan Tupper.
Encourage the development of land with smaller lot sizes that would allow for the building of manufactured homes. Within town, we could encourage more accessory dwelling units. Within town, we could encourage, and even a new newly annexed properties, the use of planned use developments where you can take two or three lots and reconfigure them, do some zero lot line building and potentially put in a lot of duplexes and things like that. So those are, you know, immediately available. I like accessory dwelling units, but there are some difficulties with our codes and zoning to maybe make the best use of those that we could, because that would allow a lot of people to help someone else with an ADU on their property as a temporary, maybe with a conditional use permit that would expire after 5 years, to facilitate bridging the amount of time we have to really solve that.
What I do know is we, as a city, are really hamstrung by what we can do. We don't have the local control that I wish we did. So one of the biggest things, honestly, that we can do is to work with the Association of Idaho Cities, which the city is a member of, because they help work with our legislators. They're down there working with them all the time. They work with us, and we talk to our legislators. We talk to people that are like-minded in the legislature, trying to figure out what can we do, because a lot of times we're not able to do what we want to because we're not allowed to because the law won't let us. The other thing I think we do look at is finding incentives for developers, because we can't tell the developers, you have to do it this way. We can encourage, and we can try and give them incentives, but it's basically a private business. We can't tell them, you have to do this. We don't do that to a private business. So we need to find ways to work with them before they are committed to doing that development. And all those things are possible, and it's going to take work from all of us. It's not easy work. The developers make more money when they have big houses, right? And so to tell them, hey, don't make so much money. Let's have more duplexes, smaller houses. Let's put them together. We have to find a way to incentivize that.
There is a lot of political actions we could take, but we don't have the ability to do because Boise's in charge of a lot of stuff that we're not. And housing is one of those things, unfortunately. But housing itself I see as two problems specifically. First, it's humanitarian. And secondly, it's an economic problem. The humanitarian, it's obvious. It's obvious that we should always look for ways to get people housing. That's a very good sentiment to have. But let's break down the economics of it. Let's look at every single stage of what it means to build a duplex, an apartment building, a house. And let's look, as a government, of ways to build public and private cooperation of lowering the cost of construction, seeing what it takes to make sure that growth can match our rate of housing development. Because growth has been outpacing development for a long time now, and that's a problem for a city. We need to bump those numbers up. It's important for us. It's very important for me personally, because coming here when I was 19, there weren't a lot of options, and I did not want a lot of the options that were handed over to me, so I dealt with what I had. I don't want people to face what I faced when I was 19, where they are stuck with whatever they get. But the biggest part of it is looking at all of the processes that it takes to build a home and seeing where we as a government and as private firms can cooperate to make sure the costs go down so that rents go down and that mortgages go down.
That was Moscow City Council candidate Nathan Tupper, preceded by incumbent candidate Sandra Kelly, and we started that clip with former Board of Adjustment member Evan Holmes. On the same question of housing, candidate Bryce Blankenship spoke about the investment firm Hurst & Son, which recently purchased 6 trailer courts in the vicinity of Moscow and is raising rents on tenants. Blankenship posited the city could get predatory companies to give tenants adequate notice of rent increases. Here's Blankenship, followed by Joe Campbell and current city council member Drew Davis.
I really wish that as a city we could kind of produce ordinances and produce ordinances that encourage inclusionary zoning, inclusionary zoning. But unfortunately, we are hamstrung as a city, kind of from the state level, to be able to do that, which would encourage developers to allocate a certain amount of their properties that they're building that would be affordable housing for those. But unfortunately, that is kind of tied up in the courts as of right now in the state. The other thing that I think we should consider as it relates to access to affordable housing, and I think that as a community we should be concerned about, is that there has been a predatory practice of a particular company named Hurst & Sons that is coming around, and they've been buying a lot of the mobile home communities scattered across the Northwest in particular, and giving the residents really no time to kind of make certain decisions as it relates to raising their rent and as it relates to certain things that occur within those communities. And so as a city councilor and on council, one thing that I would encourage us to do would be able to pass certain ordinances that encourage those type of companies that come into those mobile home communities to give greater notice of when they're raising rents to the residents there, that give them more time to prepare on what they can do within their means to do so. Because I think that, again, we can be really intentional and really thoughtful with how we approach issues surrounding affordable housing.
I think that there are some really interesting developments in Moscow, lower income, like 400,000 below. I think the Southview, East Palouse River Drive, Barley Flats area. I think some of these are very interesting. I think they might encourage other developers. It would be really nice if we could get some development from the university, the downtown area, maybe some townhouses or some apartments or something like that.
Nils Peterson, he runs this organization in town that is trying to get people, you know, better housing options. One thing that we've done is they did a partnership with the University of Idaho, the architecture department. To be all fair, I'm very biased. I graduated from there. I also lecture in that department. A lot of these people are my colleagues. However, the work they're doing is critical. They're bringing in students to build these. They're teaching students skills. With those skills that they're bringing in, they're solving a problem. It's not, it's moving. We've all heard the analogy. You walk down a beach, how do you save a starfish? It's filled with them. They're throwing one starfish in at a time. I know we need to do more. We have a supply and a demand problem. But some things that I've found from my personal practice, practicing architecture, is infill. Infill is critical. We look around. We've talked about accessory dwelling units. That's a big deal. If you build one, we don't want to tell you what to do with your land, but you know, you can turn it into Airbnb, but there's people that need houses here.
That was incumbent Moscow City Council candidate Drew Davis, preceded by candidates Joe Campbell and Bryce Blankenship. The three are among the 6 candidates for Moscow City Council this year. Davis, who you just heard from, joined the council in December of last year after Mayor Art Bedke appointed him to fill the remaining months in Councilmember Ann Zabala's term after Zabala resigned to move to another country. Voters can cast ballots for up to 3 candidates, and the top 3 vote-getters will join Haley Lewis, Julia Parker, and Gina Taruccio on the council. Lewis, Parker, and Taruccio have 2 years remaining in their terms. KRFP will air more from the Moscow League of Women Voters City Council Candidates Forum during upcoming newscasts. We also have planned call-in forums for City Council candidates, including one scheduled for next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. on the radio. The Moscow League of Women Voters will hold another candidates forum at the 1912 Center tonight, this time for school board candidates. The candidates are for Zone 1 incumbent Jim Frenzel and challenger Cody Barr, for Zone 3 incumbent Dulce Kirsting Lark and challenger Gay Lynn Clyde, and for Zone 4, incumbent Don Fazio and challenger Jim Gray. Gray ran for Moscow mayor in 2021. The winner in those three races will join Brian Kennedy and Ken Fonts on the five-seat school board. Kennedy and Fonts have 2 years remaining in their terms. The Moscow League of Women Voters Candidates Forum for school board candidates tonight begins at 7 p.m. at the 1912 Center.
A key change to Montana's Landlord-Tenant Act is causing concern among people who advocate for affordable housing. The legislature shortened the amount of time a renter has to respond if they're served with eviction court papers. Amy Hall, a board member with Montana Fair Housing, says previously a tenant had 10 business days to submit a written response, giving their reasons for being allowed to stay. Now, it's half that.
That's not much time for a tenant. You know, most tenants aren't that sophisticated in legal procedures. You know, they may not know how to file an answer or what that means even to file an answer, but they have to get that done within 5 business days of getting served with the court papers.
Hall says if renters don't have the $30 needed to file a response in justice court, a judge has the power to waive that fee based on income. Tenants can ask the clerk of court for an application or find it at montanalawhelp.org. Hall encourages renters to communicate with their landlords and try to work out an agreement before it gets to the point of being served eviction papers in court. Because once a landlord files in court, renters' backs are against the wall.
When the tenant does not file an answer within the deadline given, and now it's 5 business days, they can lose automatically. The landlord can request entry of default.
In Montana, a landlord can file a court action for eviction when a renter is not complying with the terms of a lease. The most common reason for eviction is the tenant's failure to pay rent, prompting changes to the landlord-tenant agreement. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Idaho Department of Agriculture has implemented a rapid response plan after workers found invasive quagga mussels in the Snake River near Twin Falls September 18th. Within a week, the Agriculture Department announced it had closed public access to the Snake River between Niagara Springs and Twin Falls in order to prevent interference with the rapid response team working on the river. The team is surveying physical damage and collecting larvae samples. The state is also requiring anyone who used the Snake River in the Twin Falls area bring their boats, paddleboards, waders, and decoys to free hot wash stations at 2 locations in Twin Falls County. Ag Department Deputy Director Lloyd Knight told the Idaho Capital Sun the quagga mussels can impact native species, ecosystems, hydropower infrastructure, municipal and agricultural water users. Knight said, left unchecked, quagga mussels can cover the surfaces of dams, canals, and waterways. They can plug pipes. They are filter feeders that outcompete all other species for nutrients and have substantially changed ecosystems.
When Crevice Mining Group, LLC, made moves in 2021 to establish a gold mine on lands directly upslope from the Yellowstone River and in plain view from Yellowstone National Park, the team that successfully stopped mining in Gardner Basin and Paradise Valley went to work. This week, Scott Christensen with the Greater Yellowstone Coalition announced they had raised the $6.25 million needed to buy out the mining group's claim.
People care about the park and the lands that surround it, its wildlife, its water resources, just a really great reminder of how important Yellowstone is to so many people all around the world, and of course here locally as well.
The campaign to protect nearly 1,600 acres of watershed and wildlife habitat adjacent to the park, which went public in May of this year, brought in over 1,300 donations from 47 states and 7 countries. Critics of the buyout say it will mean the loss of royalties for state coffers and good-paying jobs. The coalition feared that mining activities on the South south slope of Crevice Mountain would put the Yellowstone River directly below at risk. Christensen believes that preserving landscapes is a better economic path than short-term mining projects, which, unlike outdoor recreation and wildlife tourism, typically see revenues leaving local communities.
Yellowstone is more valuable than gold. It generates hundreds of millions of dollars every year for local gateway communities, and that is all at risk on the northern boundary of the park if the river is polluted, if wildlife habitat is lost and destroyed.
The parcel is also one of the few designated places outside the park where Yellowstone bison can roam. The coalition plans to transfer ownership to the Custer-Gallatin National Forest to open the area to the public, permanently protect it from future mining, and help wildlife.
It's occupied grizzly bear habitat. It's right in the middle of the Northern Range elk herd migration corridor. You know, it's used by mule deer, bighorn sheep, and all sorts of different animals that use the park itself.
This is Eric Galatis for the Wyoming News Service.
Emissions from buildings are a dangerous source of air pollution across the nation, according to a new report. The analysis says the burning of fossil fuels from building and home appliances contributes harmful particles into the air. Dylan Plummer with Sierra Club in the Northwest says outdoor air impacts from fossil fuel use in this sector is not just a threat inside buildings.
As that gas is being vented outside, it's putting dangerous levels of nitrous oxide into the air that are in turn having really dramatic health impacts on these communities.
Plummer says, taken together, homes in Washington state emit about five times as much nitrogen oxide as gas-fired power plants. Nitrogen oxides contribute to climate change and are linked to harmful health impacts. The report was released by Sierra Club, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and We Act for Environmental Justice. Plummer notes people of color are disproportionately affected by poor outdoor air pollution from buildings.
These communities that are historically marginalized are oftentimes living in areas with higher density of gas use or other pollutants that further exacerbate the nitrous oxide pollution associated with buildings.
Plummer says Washington State is taking steps to clean up pollution in this sector, especially in new buildings. On a federal level, Sierra Club and 25 other organizations urged the Environmental Protection Agency last year to regulate building emissions. He says all electric appliances are a viable alternative to the harmful status quo.
Just like we don't build cars without seatbelts anymore, we shouldn't be building appliances that are putting out deadly pollutants, especially not ones that are being used in homes with children and elderly and other vulnerable populations.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Pullman City officials announced they have wrapped up the arterial street resurfacing project to improve road and sidewalk conditions on College Hill 2 weeks early. According to documents posted on the city's website, the $1.6 million project began in June and was scheduled for completion by mid-October. Workers for contractor Motley Motley were resurfacing Merman and Westwood Drives. A federal grant funded the project. The street project was divided into two phases. Road crews worked on Merman Drive and Terview Drive to Westwood Drive, then switched to Westwood Drive from Merman to Northwood Drive. In Phase 1, crews repaved Merman Street and completed bus pullout work, utility cover changes, concrete and curb construction, pavement striping, sign installation, and other minor utility repairs. Workers completed that phase late last month. There was an issue with the failure to meet material specifications of the asphalt mix. Motley Motley removed and replaced the asphalt surface at no cost. According to an email from Pullman Communications Manager Sarah Phelan Barnes, there were various factors which allowed the project to be completed early, but mainly it was the efficiency of the contractor. According to the Daily News, Phelan Barnes wrote in her email, "The city is pleased to have an end product that meets all requirements and that is set to be long-lasting improvements for residents. This is especially true as, prior to this project, both Merman and Westwood Drives were in need of attention." The Latah County Broadband Coalition introduced Kylie Holvek as its new digital literacy coordinator, whose job will be helping people master barriers to digital accessibility. According to a Latah County news release, Holvik's job will include leading outreach efforts and conducting listening sessions to assist people's understanding of some of the barriers associated with digital access. According to the Daily News, some of the target populations include low-income households, the elderly, incarcerated people, veterans, disabled people, citizens with language barriers, racial and ethnic minorities, and rural residents. The news release said the new coordinator will also add support to enhance affordable connectivity program awareness and increase enrollment. The $14 billion Affordable Connectivity Program provides discounts for eligible households of up to $30 per month toward broadband internet service and up to $100 towards a one-time purchase of a computer, laptop, or tablet. The news release also said Holvik will participate in next Wednesday's Latah County Broadband Coalition meeting set for 10 a.m., Those who are interested may join the meeting via Microsoft Teams by going to the Latah County website or viewing the meeting at their local library branch. 20-year-old Damon Ward and 21-year-old Gracie C. Dansero of Pomeroy pleaded not guilty to charges they abused a three-month-old infant in Garfield County Superior Court yesterday. According to the Lewiston Tribune, court documents say police arrested Ward and Dansero last month on a Class A felony charge of first-degree aggravated assault of a child. The charges come with a maximum penalty of life in prison. Dansero is being held in the Whitman County Jail, and Ward is in the Asotin County Jail. Court documents say Ward has been charged with four counts of first-degree assault of a child, and Dansero is charged with three counts of first-degree assault of a child and a gross misdemeanor charge of failure to report child abuse. According to the Washington State Patrol and Spokane detectives, a critical care pediatric physician told police the abuse took place over a period of time, saying he was, quote, quote, sure, this trauma was caused by abuse. The doctor backed the allegations. He said the male infant had swelling and bleeding in the brain, multiple broken leg bones, and damage and swelling in one of his hands. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it will be mostly clear tonight through Sunday, with patchy fog after 4 a.m. and before 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. Low 44 tonight, highs 74 tomorrow and Saturday, 76 on Sunday, and lows 46 Friday and Saturday night. Current temperature 66. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica, and then at 7:30, appearing locally, music from bands and artists that are appearing in the Moscow-Pullman area in the near future. At 8 o'clock, Maximum Rock and Roll. And at 9 o'clock, the Academy is on to play 2 hours of music for you in the Not Dark Yet show. At 11 o'clock, we will have 2 hours of recorded jam band concert music with the syndicated show The Ride. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow-Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.
KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.